You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
Henry van Zanden, geboren in Australië in 1956, januari 1956. Geboren uit twee Nederlandse ouders. Henry, kunnen wij Nederlands praten?
No, I understood what you said, but like I was born in Australia in Cooma in 1956, but my parents were born overseas.
Right, and talking Dutch hasn't been one of the elements that you were grown up with.
No, well, my parents said, well, we live in Australia now, and they made a conscious effort not to teach us Dutch.
Oh, right, okay.
So they said, no, you've got to learn English, even though you can't help pick up some words and you can understand things, you know.
Yeah. But when I say Henry van Zanden, that sounds okay to your ears.
Oh, yeah. You think you're born, and that's where you're born, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Henry, you are a historian, and let's say James Cook didn't discover Australia. That's what you have discovered.
No, well, 164 years before Cook, we had Captain Willem Janszoon. He discovered Australia in late January or early February in 1606 in the ship the Duifken.
The Duifken.
Yeah, it means little dove.
Yeah, and this is what you have been writing about in your series Australia Discovered?
Yes, I'm writing a series of six or seven books, but it's been a bit like Star Wars. I haven't actually started with the first book, which is 1606 Discovery of Australia. I ended up starting with the second last book. Then I did the 1629 Mutiny on the Batavia. Then I did the last book. I'm doing Abel Tasman now, and I'm going to the Netherlands in June, July, so that I can write 1606 Discovery of Australia.
Yeah, wow. So your first book has been The Lost White Tribes of Australia, Part 1?
That's right, yeah.
And then you have added Part 2. But
yeah.
Let's start about the Lost White Tribes. I mean, so there are Dutch roaming Australia in the 17th century.
Yeah, well, what happened was you had a ship called the Gouden Draak. It was going on the usual course discovered by Hendrik Brouwer in 1611, whereby instead of going diagonally from Cape Town to Batavia, they found it was much quicker and safer if they used the Roaring Forties and they had the wind. They didn't have to change the direction of the sail too much. They just pushed the ship all the way across the Indian Ocean in very quick time. And when they thought that they got to a certain longitude, a bit of a guessing on their part, they turn north. Now sometimes some of these ships, they turn north a little bit late and ended up too close to the coast or the West Australian coast, and that's what happened to the Gouden Draak. It hit a hidden reef at 6.5 kilometres off the West Australian coast, which is about 100 kilometres north of Perth.
Right, so they had shipwreck, and did they survive?
Well, some died, but most of the people came were able to get off the ship, including 10 women. And we know what happened. We know that they survived because 7 of the sailors, or the best fittest sailors, they took the one remaining longboat.
Yeah.
And they rowed all the way back, using a sail too, of course, all the way back to Batavia to raise the alarm to try and get help. Now, they did have another long boat, but that was smashed to pieces on the beach. Yeah, and of course I went down there and had a good look. And what strikes you immediately when you walk along the beach there and walk along the entire area there where they came on the coast there, it's very barren, even though there's plenty of vegetation. It's all very low-lying, and you don't see any animals. There's very little water, although looked like there was a bit of a well there. And according to a journal that was written much later on by an English explorer who interviewed these Dutch people when he found them in 1832. It was on the advice of the Ten Sisters, I assume that's the women, that they should travel east. Now, travelling east in West Australia is going inland.
Yeah.
And right along the West Australian coast, there's a limestone ridge. From the ridge to the ocean, it's very rugged and very rough. But from once you cross the ridge, you don't get all that stone anymore. But standing on top of the ridge, they would have been able to see, in the distance, these tall trees and birds flying around. And they would have been able to see these tall trees because there's hardly any tall trees at all along the coast there. They're mostly just a bit above the height of a person, you know, no more than 2 metres or something, all the trees. But because there was so much water there, that's where they went. And then they came across an Aboriginal tribe there, and according to accounts by Aboriginals who spoke to the first explorers and settlers who arrived in that area, they said that they, for several years, they talked about this white tribe living on the northern side of a river. And they said they made merrymaking for several years. In other words, they lived together for a little bit, but then suddenly they separated. And the white tribe stayed by themselves on the northern side of the river where they built long walls to defend themselves, and the black tribes stayed to the southern side. And they frequently had battles against each other. Mm. And according to the Aboriginal tribe, they said the white tribe more often than not won. And I should tell you how I come across this. There was an article in the Leeds Mercury newspaper.
Yeah.
25th of January, 1834. All right. Well, 5, I can't remember the exact date. And what was happening in the early 1830s is that the Swan River colony, or that's the West Australian colony, was on its last legs. It was people were desperate there. There had originally been over 4,000 colonists, and now it was less than 1,000. People were leaving. Governor Stirling was desperate. So he was sending out explorers to try and find some rich, fertile land, but especially water, a really good source of water. And Robert Dale, he was his favourite explorer, he went north, and he came across this massive lake, huge lake, a freshwater lake. And in the distance, he could see these people in canoes, you know, going very, very skillfully in and out of the tiny little islands there. They seemed to be fishing. And as he walked further on down the hill, he suddenly came across a white man. And they both were absolutely startled. And the white man was all dressed in kangaroo skins, and he spoke Dutch to Dale. Now, Dale had spent some time in the Netherlands, so he knew a bit of old Dutch. And Dutchman gave a story about his tribe, about how they ended up there. And when Robert Dale ended up in that area, there were 300 Dutchmen living there by 1832. So that was really amazing. And then they accurately told Dale when they arrived. They're only a few years out, in 1656. And they said there were, in the end, there were 79 of them altogether. And they explained how they lived. They still had nominal marriages. They still had Sabbath on the Sunday.
Wow.
But they were very conscious of needing to protect themselves. And they weren't very keen to leave that area because that's where all the fresh water was.
Yeah.
And so they had a standing army, and for about age of 10 or something, every male was a member of that army. Yeah, so they were all the time worried about their defence.
Yeah.
And, well, Daly came back to Governor Stirling and he said, look, I've got some amazing news. I found this white tribe. But there was a big problem. They couldn't tell everybody about this white tribe because when Stirling had been pushing very hard for this colony, and the government wasn't really interested because they said this belongs to the Dutch. and he was releasing stories that the French would take it in the newspaper. You know, these oral stories in the newspaper. So in the end, the British government relented and said, okay, we'll help you set up, but then you're on your own. We're not spending any money. And if you find a white settlement there, or there's evidence of prior occupation, then all bets are off. You know, you can't claim it as British.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did find. That was quite embarrassing, because it put into question, legal question, the ownership of all that land that they were just given out. And when the Dutch protested in the 2nd of May 1829, when the British annexed New Holland,
yeah,
the British said, well, look, you've got, okay, fair enough, you discovered it, but you've got no settlement there. So therefore, we're claiming it as British. So this would have been highly embarrassing. And at the same time that was happening, Belgium was breaking away from the Netherlands at that stage. It was like a civil war. There's the Netherlands and Belgium were at war. And although the British government was supposed to be allied with the Dutch, they in fact helped the Belgians to the extent that they were confiscating or legally confiscating Dutch shipping. It was quite extraordinary. It was like legalised piracy at sea.
Yeah.
So all these things were highly embarrassing. So anything that should surface in Britain at this time, such as the finding of a white tribe, would have been highly embarrassing to the British government. And when the British government said to Stirling, no, we're not going to help you, well, he released this news article in the Leeds Mercury newspaper, and that's the second largest daily newspaper outside London. And in the article, it talked about, it was really just an excerpt from Robert Dale's journal, but he did change some details. He changed the name of Dale, and he changed some details about exactly where this Lost White Tribe was. But he left some clues there, deliberately left some clues, because I'm sure he wanted them to be found eventually. You know?
Yeah.
And the clues that he left was in the longitude. Now, if you use Greenwich, I don't know if you understand Greenwich, you've got zero meridian going through Greenwich,
yeah,
in
yeah.
England.
Yeah.
Well, that was a British invention.
Yep.
Before that, the Portuguese and the Spanish and the French went through the zero meridian, went through Tenerife.
All right.
Okay. Now, if you had a look at the newspaper article, the meridian of the Lost White Tribe went through Central Australia. That didn't make sense. But when you transpose that to the Portuguese and Spanish meridian,
yeah,
the longitude goes exactly through the Lost White Tribe where I discovered them.
Wow.
And I found the map of the Lost White Tribe in the Mitchell Library, because I thought, I knew that they'd got rid of the journal, but I thought they've slipped up somewhere, I'm sure they'll make a mistake somewhere, and they'll have left in a detail in the journal somewhere. So, you know, and I got hold of an original version of the several explorations in West Australia by Joseph Cross. In the back of that book, it's only a relatively small book, all neatly folded, and it's quite big when you unfold it, was a map. And on that map, it had one journey, exploration journey, that wasn't spoken about in the journals. So that's how I knew where the Lost White Tribe was.
Wow.
Right, so, and I checked again, rechecked, you know, read it three times. So they, even though they'd taken out the journal entry, they didn't take it out of the map. So I spent a bit of money scanning the map, because you weren't allowed to photocopy it. Then I took that map with me back to West Australia. Spent a few days looking for it. I couldn't find it. So in the end, I just got my backpack on, the compass, took the and started walking and just followed the details on the map. There it was. I found it.
This is an amazing,
very exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. This is an amazing story. I mean, so what did you really encounter when you found it?
Well, I had to. All the details had to fit exactly with the Leeds Mercury article, and so I'd already. I could see it in the distance, but I had to stop myself from going there straight away because I had to rule out all the other hills first. And I had to be pointing in the right direction because I had to be looking southwards at the top of the hill. And I had to be also looking down upon a massive amount of water.
Yeah.
Now, even though that water is no longer there today, you could still see the outline of the lake. And the only reason why the lake is not there is because the river that used to flow into the lake now flows into the sea. And I took a landscape archaeologist with me, and she confirmed that the river had changed its course, so it now bypassed the lake. And then everywhere else around that whole area, I was told that there was no stone, unless it would have been in the middle of the lake. And I thought, well, they're not going to settle inside the middle of the lake.
No.
And this was the only place there was a lot of stone. And I saw all these long lines of stones. I don't know how deep it was. It looks like they've been maybe put into a trench even. I'm not too sure. There seemed to be outlines of rooms or walls all around the top part of the river, or the northern part of the river. And that all fitted in nicely in with the Leeds Mercury article. And then later on, I found artefacts there.
You know, like?
It was quite extraordinary, really, because I went there with the archaeologist, and she said, look at this stone here. And I said, okay, it was a low-lying, large rock, rather, and it was all hollowed out. It looked like a bath. She said, I think that's probably where they maybe baptised the baby, she said, you know, or at least had a bath here. And it's close to the river. And I went over to look at it, and I was able to pull out some flat stones, they're completely different stones, so it was obviously deliberately put in there. One side, or the top side, was flat, and underneath it was rough. So they obviously wanted to smooth out the top part of that bath. And then right next to it, there's this huge boulder with a hole in it.
Yeah.
I thought, well, if I was going to put something away, I would use this hole like a cupboard. I dug out the dirt, and I dug out about seven different stone tools.
Wow.
That was quite extraordinary, really. And just at the top of that, there was a oven tree. Now, she said it was definitely 300 years old. These are all close proximity to each other, you know, 20 metres. She said that's where they would have cooked the yams. It's like a sweet potato.
Yeah.
And in the river below, there was a stone fish trap. In other words, that's where they would make it like a stone dam, enough for the water to get through.
Yeah.
But they could still trap the fish.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was quite extraordinary, really. And I can't tell you where it is because the guy who owns the property said he'd sue me if I mentioned the name. So in any other book, you know. So it's already in the first book, of course. But
yeah.
And if anyone does go down there, please don't go down there and annoy this fellow because he gets very upset.
sbs.com.au